Background and goals of the Center of Southwest Studies. Let's now join our hosts.
Tonight, we weren't fortunate enough to have our guest with us that had planned to be here, so we're falling back on a program that we prepared quite some time ago. And Dr. Delaney has been head of the Center for Southwest Studies since its inception. And Doctor, can you tell us something of the background and the goals of the Center for Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis?
Well, I think I can, Arthur. The Center of Southwest Studies was started in 1964, and the idea was to collect and collate and have ready to use by anybody who wants to use it all materials dealing with the southwestern part of the United States and the Four Corners area in particular. And since that time, I've been collecting mainly research material. It's at the point right now where, for instance, we have in the center over 3,500 rolls of microfilm of primary source material. We have everything on Indians, all Indians, not just Southwest, that was ever microfilmed in the National Archives of the United States, going back to before the United States was the United States. And the main part of it is Southwestern Indians, plus many rolls that we selected and had filmed in the National Archives, all of the censuses of Indians, any tribe, or all of the letters sent, letters received from the superintendents of agencies, and so on. We were fortunate this last year in acquiring a tremendous amount of material from the Indian Rights Association in Philadelphia. This was an organization of very prominent people in the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, several other presidents, and prominent people from all around the country who were interested in the rights of the Indians. The letters they wrote, the pamphlets they published, and so on. We have them all. Then, scholars now are beginning to come from, it saves them a trip to Washington, you mm-hmm. see, are beginning to come from all over the western part of the United States to use the collection. Then I have been fortunate in getting a tremendous amount of mining material, material on railroads. I don't have too many records of the cattle industry. Some of them didn't keep records, and a lot of them have been thrown away and so on. The photograph collection of Durango, old businesses of Durango, Silverton, the mines, the mills, the smelters, all of this in the general area is getting to be a sizable collection, plus photos of Indians that we got from the Hay Foundation in New York, photos of, I think, about 150 different well-known Indians, very fine photos. The map collection is getting to be quite big with maps even going back to 1540, several of them, for instance, showing California as an island, for instance. This land up here is Tierra Incognita, unknown land, unexplored, and so on and so on. Well, anyway, that's, you may have noticed that beginning this fall, I will devote full time to teaching and to directing the Center of Southwest Studies, because it's getting to be about as big a research center. Now, I'm not saying we have as much as Bancroft Library in California, although we have more on Indians than Bancroft does. But it's getting to be one of the biggest research centers in the western part of the United States.
And all because of the I guess maybe the generosity of the people around here in this area to come up with these things.
Yes, that's partly it, and partly a grant from the federal government last year, and some things like that. But the people of this area have been very, very generous with donating records to the center. And believe me, you never know what a student is going to use. Mainly, of course, this is for our students. Each one of our students, before he gets out, has to do an independent study or a seminar paper, and they use them for this. But now, people who are writing master's theses and even doctoral dissertations are using the collections, And even people who have PhDs and so on, recognized writers and scholars, are using it. Several are coming right away, and several already have, as far as that goes.
You've now, had considerable help from the Indians, too, haven't you?
I've had considerable help from the Indians in collecting materials. Now, I brought down tonight, these are mainly artifacts and not research materials, but just to give the people an idea of the things that we're trying to collect and have ready for use by anybody who wants to find out what his heritage in the San Juan Basin is.
Well, now, you get out a catalog.
Yes,
your research material.
Yes, we got this out last year. It's already out of date. We've gotten so much more material. I had sections in here on the Spanish archives of New Mexico that we have on Parral. We have the Parral is a town in northern Mexico, South Chihuahua, but we have all of their archives. It's more than 300,000 pages of documents on microfilm. Now, that doesn't, it's in Spanish, of course, but the point was that Parral was a frontier area and had a lot to do with expeditions jumping off from Parral up into New Mexico and even up into this area, possibly, and over into Arizona and so on. So there is a lot of material there going back to the early 1600s.
Well, didn't nearly all of the early Spanish history, exploration in this area from which we get our history, start from Parral mostly?
Well, a lot of it did in Santa Barbara in the central part. Of course, Coronado came up the west.
It was a military headquarters for quite a large area, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. And then later on, Chihuahua came to be. And so a lot of the things, particularly the military stuff that you would find in the Chihuahua archives are also in the Parral archives, and we have all of those. And for instance, one man... he's a well-known writer in the West, Oka Jones. He's over at the Air Force Academy. He's coming over this month to look up some more things on the Pueblo Indians from the Parral archives, just as an example.
Well, now you see something else interesting. There's two old Spanish military chests up at the Center for Southwest Studies that was used to haul military supplies on the old two-wheeled carts in the early days.
Way, way back.
And that goes way back because they're old military chests and they're part of the archives of the Center for Southwest Studies now.
Yes. Some other things that I thought...
We don't know where to start, do you?
we won't get through this. But just as an example, I brought here, I think, about six photos that Dr. Ochsner took. He was a pioneer in photography. So far as I know, and I think his niece told me this, he didn't like to be photographed himself, although he's an expert photographer, and this is, as far as she knows, the only photo of Dr. Ochsner, whom many people here in Durango and the surrounding area will remember.
When did he take these pictures, and when were these things taken? What era? I mean, what span of years?
from around 90, from World War One up until...
World War One in through the...
40s, late 40s.
Yes. Late but he was a pioneer in several processes. Let me give you an example. This is a carbo photo. I hope that doesn't glare too much.
Now, this is in color.
Yeah, well, now, and it doesn't show up there in the black and white, but it's a beautiful color, isn't it?
Yes,
now, that
it
was
is.
Done very with good. Some type. I don't understand the process very well. A carbo process, it's called. Done with some type of carbon paper. And it was a very delicate process, and of course very costly. Mm-hmm. And the new film and so on does it so much better that this passed out of existence.
Really, that is so almost so perfect. It looks like you just took it yesterday. You know,
he was an
expert.
The fantastic
color film we have today.
And to give you an idea, Dan, of how expert he was, take a look at the back of that, because these are stickers of places where this particular photo was displayed, and it was displayed in England, in France, in Germany, in Canada, in many different places. Switzerland, too,
Switzerland.
And many different places in the United States. Now, I just brought some of these along as an example. This collection of photos amounts to 375 of these. Not all of them are in color, by any means, but about 10% of them are in color and would be collector's items because of the old process used.
Now, this is just the Upland Pastures.
Yes, he called that the Upland Pastures. This was taken out of the old Fort Lewis campus, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Not at Hesperus.
Yes. He took a lot of them. This one here is Electra Lake. You can see Engineer. You can see Engineer in the background there.
Now, this must have been done in the 40s or something, because there's a motorboat on the...
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. This one, the late ones. Mm-hmm. And, get that glare off. He was very good with clouds, sometimes taking clouds from one photo that he had taken and superimposing it on another. He was an expert at this.
Oh,
well, that's just as an example. I'll have a showing of those some day. I mentioned photos of Durango. This is the first hanging in Durango in 1882. A man convicted of murder, a man by the name of Wood, right across from where the Strader is, up the hill this side. From where the Strader is. Now, this photo, many people have seen this. There are several copies of this around.
Would that be located about where Moorhart Chevrolet is now? Pretty close right there?
Between there and Main Street about.
Between there and Main
Street,
something.
Yeah, right in there someplace, or maybe over to the right if you're looking west, over to the right a little bit of that.
Okay.
And, if you look, there's the hearse waiting over there. It's kind of a grim. There's a hearse there. One thing, we talk about children seeing violence today. Look at the little girl.
Little girl right here.
Yeah, the little girl.
And the man is actually on the scaffold.
Yeah, he's actually hanging.
He's actually there.
Yeah.
It's blurred because he must be kicking or something.
That's a grim thing, but it's it also. Another thing, for instance, I got these from Tennessee. Many people know that General Buell, George Buell of the Civil War fame, was out here in 1879, right after the Meeker Massacre, because they feared an uprising of the Indians. But what most people don't know is that General Buell took up a lot of mining claims out here. And as I say, I got these from Tennessee, yes. In Ruby Gulch, Junction Creek, La Plata Canyon, he had the Silver Moon Lode, the Mark Anthony Lode, and some others. Mm. And it's just an interesting piece of Americana, but I don't think most people know that General Buell was interested in mining. I'm sure he was just fooling around with, because so far as I know, he didn't come back in here after 1879. A collection that I was... very fortunate in getting recently through the generosity of Mrs. Bondure at Hesperus are the records of the Porter Fuel Company, more than the way we measure these things, more than 20 cubic feet of record. I'm not counting the canceled checks and other, of maps and things like that, records of the Porter Fuel Company going back to the 1880s. And it's just fabulous material on land, on water, on coal, on the geology of the area, the business records, the company store, all of these things.
What primarily was the purpose of the Porter Fuel Company? What were they?
They mined coal.
They were coal.
They had generally the coal rights almost entirely from Durango clear out to the other side of Hesperus.
They were about the
and
largest,
the old town of Porter.
Concern.
You see, there was the old town of Porter.
Oh, really?
Which
where?
Yes.
Up,
well,
Wildcat Canyon.
Up Wildcat Canyon.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the railroad went out there, and they shipped a lot of coal out and had a fabulous operation. The Hesperus Coal Company, which was part of that, and as I say, Ms. Bondure donated these records to the center here about Christmas time. And I actually have some markers, corner markers, the Porter Fuel Company carved in sandstone up there, but they were a little bit heavy.
This is actually a reward for no trespassing sign.
Yes, and the Crystal Coal Company. You see, not many people are collecting anything on coal mining history, and so we want to before it passes out of existence and gets all lost, because there are theses and dissertations.
Mm-hmm. But it's still a great part of the Southwest.
Yes, it is, and I hope due for a revival as they find different uses for coal and so on, because we're in a tremendous coal producing area. Other thing, I have the records of Fort Lewis as a military post. Now, this was found in the wall out there.
I have about 5,000 pages of documents of records of Fort Lewis as a military post. This is an invoice of medical supplies that was sent to the hospital at Fort Lewis. What's the date on that? Can you see?
I don't see a date on this side.
It'd be 1880-something, and 105 packages. Now, the point of this is that this would give anybody interested in medicine or pharmacology or even economics a pretty good study as to what they were using at that time, and why, and so on, and so on.
64 one-ounce bottles of Ipecac, kind of blurred, Ipecac and opium powder.
Opium powder. Dover's powder. In one-pound bottles. The records of the building of the fort, their economic studies in those. Friends, how much did nails cost? How much was lumber? How much was a bale of hay? Things like that. Well, all of this can be, you see, if a student is majoring in economics or something, this is a good study. I've collected, of course, a lot of material on Indians, as I mentioned. This is an encampment of the Utes. I don't know whether it's going to show up too well there. In 1913, over at the Garden of the Gods by Colorado Springs. And it's a big, long photo.
Buckskin Charlie.
Buckskin, oh yeah, and several others. By the way, speaking of Buckskin Charlie, here's an interesting artifact. You can't study much history on this, but maybe you can. This was used by Ouray, by Buckskin Charlie, by Ignacio, and by Severo. This calumet. And this was donated to the museum by Mr. Ed Levy, whom I think everybody in the basin knows, and who knows the history of the basin, I suspect, as well as almost anybody going. But now, this is very rare, because this calumet stone, I think, is quarried in only one place in the United States. And you see how they fitted the silver band around there. And so, of course, it was strictly for ceremonial purposes. Mm-hmm. Each person took one puff out of this after they got the tobacco, if they had it, and the dried leaves of...
Kinnikinick.
Yeah. It's a bush. Grows up in the mountains. And they used to dry the leaves of that and put it in.
Put it in the smoke.
But once they got tobacco, then, of course, they used tobacco. Here, I have many, many photos of Utes. These are photographs of Utes taken just before they were removed from their old hunting grounds.
1874.
By the way, the original, this photo, was owned by Mrs. Alva Adams. Alva Adams, many people will know, was former governor of Colorado. Arthur, do you remember, isn't this hanging in the Capitol building someplace?
Yes, I was going to tell you. I think it's in the Capitol building now.
Or
else it was over in the State Historical Society building, but they keep switching pictures over there and hanging them in the Capitol for a year or two and then taking them back and putting up others.
I think that the original of this, which Mrs. Adams had, is in the State Capitol building, but you know more about the Capitol than I do, Arthur. And these, for instance, interesting photos. These are penitentes. The Flagellant Society of generally in New Mexico in the southern part of Colorado, mm-hmm. and so on. Brotherhood that took care of widows and orphans and had a very strong organization. At Easter time, they would flagellate themselves, as penance. And they had regular ceremonies during Easter week. For instance,
they carried the cross.
I don't think this will show up on...
this is a blow-up, actually, of this particular small...
But you see the blood on the backs?
Uh-huh.
And here's another closer one, uh-huh. up by a cross. You see the blood on the backs? That'll even show up on the TV screen. There, that's it. Mm-hmm. This was down near Bondad. These are the ends of the whip. Sometimes they'd use just plain what you would call Spanish bayonet cactus or ocotilla or anything that was sharp like that. I mentioned the map collection, and I didn't bring any of the extremely old ones, but look at this one. Of the shape of Nebraska and Kansas, the Indian Territory, and New Mexico, and what is now the eastern part of Colorado. That's Nebraska that shows up so well. That's it. But you see, it isn't long and thin like as it would show up on a modern-day map when you put it with the other states. You see,
actually, Nebraska would come up the parallel here.
Yeah. You see, and you see the territory of Colorado was carved out of Nebraska and Kansas and Utah. Just that's about it. The boundary with New Mexico was set, and so on. But anyway,
well, they gained a little bit from New Mexico, didn't they? Because
yes, they.
Well, New Mexico gained a little bit out of the. Which territory is this? The white over here in this side.
That's Colorado now.
Well, this is. Well, no, I mean, what is it there?
No,
is that Utah? That Utah territory?
Over here.
Over here. This.
No. That's the east. What is now the eastern part of Colorado? This right here.
Well, wouldn't this be the eastern part of Colorado?
Oh, excuse me.
I'm looking at the wrong side of the white map.
No, you see, here's Nebraska.
Nebraska would come up here like this.
Yeah, but it extended. Later on, it extended way out here.
Oh, I see.
This was either the western part of Nebraska or the eastern part of Colorado, this part where I have my finger.
In Wyoming, you see, came out of that.
Yeah. But you see, what a weird shape.
Oh, yes.
What? Which is why that
map is
interesting. Yes. I think I can find a date on that. It was made in Pennsylvania, 1856.
Is this an actual, or is this a proof of it?
No, that was an actual map as used. This is a map of the Colorado Territory, but observe that over in our area there isn't anything whatsoever. An early map of Colorado
Territory. There's Denver.
Yeah.
And down here's Colorado City.
Well, Colorado City, you know, is the first capital.
And Canyon City.
Yeah.
But nothing over here.
Nothing over there.
Over at Sierra Leone.
In our area.
Animas River.
It says the San Luis Valley, but nothing really much in there.
Of course, they knew the rivers and the main mountains because the Spanish had explored up here and had made maps as early as Dominguez and Escalante, and their map 1776. The map actually was finally put out in 1778, not 1776, but the expedition was made in 76. And that's just a map of the military departments of New Mexico, but the good thing about this is that the military department of New Mexico took in this area up here at one time. And you know, it's a very, very difficult thing to locate exactly where the old military posts were, Fort Wimble or Fort Canby or some of these, you know. And these old maps, and we have, we must have military maps, I expect, 75. Made in the 1850s and 1860s. And you can locate these old posts on there.
See.
And they're valuable for that because there's a big interest in military forces of the West.
And see up at the top of that map, they have on there, written on there, stamped on there, unexplored.
Unexplored.
Mountains.
Well, unexplored territory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're likely to do that. These are geological. This is a geological atlas of the La Plata area, and with a great deal of natural history and geologic history and things like that. And the maps are excellently done. This La Plata Quadrangle, this was done in 1899.
Mm.
But let's get to a map. This won't show up as color, but an idea of the painstaking work that went into that.
This one right here, it says the Hogback.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, that would be a ridge.
That's just what they call it.
Mm-hmm. Hogbacks. And I don't
know
which one
that is. If you go up at the Mesa to Fort Lewis and look across at that next ridge over there, that's a Hogback.
And this serrated ridge across over here is a Hogback.
It's a Hogback, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it looked like the back of a hog, a razorback or something. This, I mentioned railroads. This is just one volume of 167 bound volumes just like this that are records of the Rio Grande Southern Railroad from 1890 until it went out of existence when the galloping gooses or geese, whichever you call it, when they quit. This is one of the 8 volumes of claims made against the railroad, for instance. Now, talk about economic studies or something like that. You can tell how many brown burros the railroad killed in any year and how much the railroad had to pay for them. Or I was reading here just a while ago, one black steer. The owners claimed it was, as I think, maybe this is human nature, a prize animal, oh, you know. Yeah. And they loved that steer and all of this, and they wanted $35 for it. But the railroad said, no, the going price for a yearling steer was $20, and that's all we're going to pay. And, of course, the railroad always tried to settle out of court because, you know, any jury trial would go against a big corporation. Or, how much they paid for how many brakemen got their thumbs smashed. You know how the old cars coupled together?
Yeah, linking pin.
Linking pin. And they were always getting their thumb in there, somebody.
Got it smashed.
And getting it smashed. Well, they had to pay some damages for that. And, of course...
And it's all in there.
Yes, in these 8 volumes of claims... Then there are bankruptcy proceedings, books just full of bankruptcy proceedings and so on. It's a tremendous amount. Now,
let's see. Dear sirs, I return herewith the above report with the result of our investigation. The tongue does not appear to have been loaded at Denver. I am unable to account for the damage to axle.
Now, if you go back, you will find references before that. That's probably a wagon or
coach
or something or something. And the number of claims against the railroad were very great. People apparently were about as bad at dipping into freight and taking out a can of oil and some things like that at that time as they are at the present time. In spite of sealed cars and the seal not broken and things like that, this crops up all over. But the most interesting part, I think, are the number of animals that were killed and the amount paid.
They got on the track.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And the train come down through and
And that heading on that says that's a list of the recent acquisitions. Is that the stuff that you have to accumulate now in the new catalog? And you've got more than that, I expect.
Yes, I have to get this into the new catalog. Involved here are an awful lot of selected documents regarding Ute Indians. There are, let me see, 6 rolls in that, 9 rolls in the other, and 1 roll, 1 having to do with the Moki, 8 rolls having to do with Fort Wingate, Fort Cameron, Utah, 2 rolls, and so on and so on. These are the ones we selected to be filmed, and there's a great deal of Indian history and settler frontier history and so on in that. And then, the Colorado newspapers and general area newspapers that we now have on microfilm are enormous. I don't think that we have as many as the Public Library in Denver, maybe, or the western area of the University of Colorado and Colorado newspapers, but we have a tremendous amount.
Yeah. Do you want to show this picture, Doctor, for the people that might not be up, have not been able to make that up to?
If
this
they
is
could
the outer
see
lobby, right?
This is the southwest room up in the new library at Fort Lewis, and this is where these things are housed and where people, if they want to use them, are free to do it. You know, I don't believe in a dog-in-the-manger attitude to this. If an 8-year-old child wants to see a document or an artifact or something and learn something about his heritage, I'm going to show it to him.
Great.
And it's for everybody, as I say, mainly the students up there, of course, but anybody who wants to use it.
Well, Doctor, we've got about 30 seconds, and the time just seems to just whiz by when we talk about this. You can never cover an ounce of it, I guess you could say.
Well, the history of the area is tremendous, and not only that, but tremendously interesting.
Yes,
and the more you dig into it, the more interesting it becomes. And there's no end to it.
That's right. Thank you both for being here tonight, and we'll look forward to having you again on San Juan Heritage.
Thank you.
Assignment 6 has brought you San Juan Heritage, produced by this station in cooperation with the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College in Durango. Your host for this series, Dr. Robert Delaney, head of the Center of Southwest Studies, and Mr. Arthur Wyatt, former Colorado State Representative and longtime resident of the Basin. Tonight's program has been entitled
background and goals of the Center of Southwest Studies. Be watching next month for the next in the current series of San Juan Heritage programs. San Juan Heritage has been engineered tonight by George Patel, camera by Steve Gilkey. This is Dan Wilson speaking and thanking you for joining us on San Juan Heritage.